And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matsuda.
Welcome, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into the Apologetic Zone, the Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Matsuda. It's great to be with you today. We got a great show in store for you. Today we're going to chat about theistic apologetics, you know, proving the existence of God. And by the way, not all theistic apologetics are the same. There are some very important differences. In fact, some of the big names in apologetics, evangelical names out there, who have really made a career out of defending the existence of God and so on, holds to a form of theistic apologetics that is called theistic personalism, which actually has a lot of problems. It's not the classical approach. So we're going to have master apologist John DeRosa. He's going to come back to the dojo, and we're going to talk about what exactly is the classical approach to proving the existence of God. How does it differ from theistic personalism? And also, you know, he's coming out with a new edition of his booklet on answering atheistic slogans. And if we have time, we're going to tackle some of those slogans as well. So we got a lot in store. It should be a lot of fun chatting with John. As always, it's always great to have him on the show. And of course, you are part of the show. And if you have a question for John DeRosa, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And you can also send your questions, by the way, at questions@handsonapologetics.com. And as always, we try to make this show not only a good show, but a show that's good for you. And to do that, we try to sharpen those skills, give you a database from which you can defend the faith competently and clearly. And part of that is critical thinking skills and also just a general knowledge of church history. And to do that, we have a finding the fallacy for the critical thinking skills, and today's finding the fallacy is the fallacy of the accident. And it's not what it sounds, folks. It's not about a car accident or something like that. It's a fallacious accident. And also, we're going to meet the early church father, and it's a biggie, Theophilus of Antioch. Very important early church father, and great stuff in store. And, you know, I think yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, now I'm looking at the live feed now, did I give my shout-outs to those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube? I think yesterday I forgot to do that. At least I had a nagging feeling after the show is, uh-oh, you know, I was so caught up in talking about heaven. I did not. Well, my apologies to Ricky and the gang and everybody else watching live stream. I want to say hi to you guys. Thank you for tuning in. It's always great to see familiar names out there and actually get some real-time feedback. Oh, hey, Ricky, I love the emojis. That's kind of cool. And also, hi, Melody and Navy 76 and all the other gang there. Appreciate it. And I also appreciate you tuning in, listening on radio and listening on podcast. And one thing you should know about the show, not only my show, Hands-On Apologetics, but all the great shows produced by Virgin Most Powerful Radio, is that you can access the shows anytime you want, at pretty much any location you want, as long as you have a media player. You just need to either get the phone app, you know, just go to your Apple iStore or whatever, and download the Virgin Most Powerful phone app, and you can access all the programs through that, or you can go to the flagship mother station, the website of virginmostpowerfulradio.org, and all the shows there are archived. You can download them, you can share them, you can do all sorts of great stuff. So you can take some of these programs, you know, with you. So just in case you're driving a car, maybe you're on going to lunch, taking an early lunch if you're on the West Coast, or taking a late lunch if you're on the East Coast, and you're going to miss part of the program, don't worry, you can always download the show via podcast. So that's just part of the services, you know, we give And also, we ask you, please keep us in your prayers. Share us. Tell people about us. You know, let people know about all the great resources we have. And also, we appreciate your generous donations as well. You know, it's we're doing the Lord's work, but we still got to pay our bills. You know, we're still part of the world. And I want to thank everybody who has donated and supported us. So I appreciate that. All right. So let's see. Did I do everything? I believe I did. So why don't we jump to our Finding the Fallacy for today? And it's a cool one. It's called The Fallacy of the Accident. Now, folks, this doesn't have anything to do with like a car accident or doing something inadvertently. Okay, it's what it is this. It's an attempt, when an attempt is made to apply a general rule to all situations when clearly there are exceptions to the rule. Okay, so that's the fallacy of the accident. When you take a general rule and you try to apply it to every case, when in fact there clearly are exceptions to that rule. Okay, this happens a lot. And it's usually, I think it's kind of almost like an overgeneralization. Kind of, this funny fallacies kind of have kissing cousins, so to speak. There are some fallacies that seem very similar to other fallacies. Let me give you a couple examples. For example, someone will say, well, my father said I should never harm a person. Therefore, I believe that as a doctor, I can never perform a surgery. Okay, so what's the general rule? The general rule is do not harm another person. And then they say, well, if that's true, then having a surgery, you're harming somebody. You know, you're sedating them, you're cutting, you're removing organs, whatever. That's harming them. So you shouldn't have surgery if that's true. Well, again, you know, obviously not to harm a person has exceptions. In fact, sometimes by committing a small harm, you can actually help correct something, like, you know, surgery would help correct some sort of health impediment. Or how thou shalt not kill, right? Okay, so there's a general rule. Therefore, it's wrong in every instance to kill somebody in self-defense. You can never kill somebody in self-defense because the Bible says thou shalt not kill. Again, you know, that would be the fallacy of the accident, because although you have the general rule, thou shalt not kill. And by the way, folks, if you don't know this, in Hebrew, it actually it makes a distinction. It doesn't say kill. It actually says murder, do murder. But anyway, the general rule, do not kill, there are exceptions. And one exception is you have a right to self-defense up to and including, using lethal force. Okay, so there is a great example, I think, of the fallacy for today, which is the fallacy of the accident. So beware, folks. You know, realize that sometimes general rules do allow exceptions. So avoid the accident of committing the accident. There you go. Yes, that is why I am the sensei, because I could do those incredible puns. Anyway, let's jump to the Meet the Early Church Fathers today, who is St. Theophilus of Antioch. St. Theophilus of Antioch died sometime around AD 185 or AD 191. Not really sure when he died. By the way, this makes him a contemporary of another very important early church father in apologetics, St. Irenaeus of Lyon, who flourished around 180. So, you know, he's kind of contemporary with St. Irenaeus. Although Irenaeus, of course, was in the West, you know, in modern-day France or Gaul, where Theophilus is in the East with Antioch. Okay, so what do we know about Theophilus of Antioch? Well, a little bit, but not a lot. Theophilus was the seventh bishop of Antioch. He's sixth successor from St. Peter in Antioch. So if you recount, Peter was in Antioch. He functioned as bishop there, and then he left. And then there was a succession of bishops from him. Theophilus is the sixth after Peter. Little is known about him besides the details in his work. And we only have one work. It's to Autolycus. We know that he was born near the Euphrates and that he converted from paganism to Christianity as an adult. And after having made careful study of scriptures, you know, he came into Christianity, and that's pretty much all we know about him. Other than he probably died somewhere between the year 185 and 191 AD. Now, he has one writing, and this is the writing to Autolycus, which was written, you know, a few years before Theophilus' death. And it's the only surviving work we have. It's a work that's contained in three books. The third book contains a chronology of the world from the end of the death of Marcus Aurelius on March 17th of 180. So that's basically why scholars assume, well, since the chronology ends with Marcus Aurelius, obviously the book had to be written before that. So that's basically it. Now, why is it important? Well, Theophilus of Antioch actually mentions the Trinity, and in this work he goes into detail on the Trinity and also about the nature of God and other things too. For example, this is kind of a cool passage. He says, the 3 days before the luminaries were created are types of the Trinity. So he's referring back to the Genesis, right, with creation, and specifically the first 3 days. And he says, in those first 3 days of Genesis, you actually have types of the Trinity. You have God, you have his word, and you have his wisdom. So, cool stuff from St. Theophilus of Antioch. Coming up on the other side of the break, folks, we have Master Apologist John DeRosa coming on. We're going to talk about classical theism and answering slogans and all sorts of really cool stuff. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to talk about theistic apologetics, explaining the existence of God, his attributes, and so on. And are all the same? Is every approach to proving the existence of God of equal value, or Are some better than the other? Is there a classic way of doing it? And also, how do you answer slogans? Things like that. So anyhow, we invite Master Apologist John DeRosa into the dojo. John has an undergraduate degree in math education from the College of New Jersey, an MA in Pure and Applied Mathematics at Mount Clair State University. But many of you may know John's work through his website, which is classicaltheist.com. And John DeRosa, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Gary Machuda, thanks again for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, it's there's so much we could talk about. I don't even know where we could start. You know, at the beginning of the show, I teased a little bit because I said there are many prominent here defending the existence of God, and they do some very good work. But their tactic isn't what we would call the classical approach to defending God. And, of course, that is your claim to fame, my friend, is classical theism, right? So maybe let's talk a little bit about that. What's the difference? What's the alternative to classical theism? What is classical theism?
Sure. No, and I thank you for that introduction. Though I'm going to stress, we call ourselves studious amateurs over at my site, Classical Theism. We are learning from people before us. We're not trying to get great fame. We're not trying to put other people down. We're just trying to get as much possible into what truths we can uncover about the nature of God. And what we would say as classical theists, you know, there are some distinctions we'll make, and I'm going to talk about it. I got a nice PDF. What is classical theism and why should we hold to it? But the basic idea refers to the traditional conception of God in Western culture, especially among Catholicism, where God is seen as the metaphysically necessary and ultimate foundation of all reality. So, you know, considered in himself, okay, he's not some kind of material or spiritual item. You know, he's not just one other thing that has being. The traditional phrase, according to Aquinas, is God is subsistent being itself. Okay. Or we might say, you know, the ultimate metaphysical foundation of all reality, which entails some different things about God, namely that he's going to be radically different than his creatures. Now, at this point, we're just talking about God's existence. We're not going into the fact of the incarnation when God adjoined to himself, or the technical word, assumed a human nature. So you might have that in the back of your mind when God became man in Jesus Christ. And of course, in that sense, he has a full human nature and can do all that stuff. What we're talking about, though, is God in his divine nature when we say classical theism. So that's the first idea. And by metaphysically necessary, just to unpack some of those terms, because once you start looking into scholasticism, when you start reading Edward Fazer, when you start getting more into this stuff, you're going to uncover a lot of terminology. And so one of the things I like to do in the PDF is I kind of unpack some of this terminology as I distinguish classical theism. So metaphysically necessary, by that we mean, you know, God cannot possibly not exist. He didn't begin to exist. He will never go out of existence. He necessarily exists and will always exist. Okay, he exists by his very nature, we can say. And by the ultimate foundation of reality, we mean there's nothing else responsible for holding God in existence. He doesn't depend on anything else. His existence and action, they're first in being, not necessarily in a temporal sense. Like, for example, Aquinas thought you couldn't disprove that the universe was infinite. He believed it by divine revelation, but he said he couldn't prove it philosophically. So I'm not talking in a temporal sense, but when it comes to any chain of moved movers or contingent beings or explanations, God is the grounding point. He's the fundamental rock bottom of that chain. So when you go to make arguments for classical theism, that's naturally the approach you're going to take, whether you start with arguments for motion. That's the first way of Aquinas. You look at, he uses a hand which moves a stick, which moves a stone, and he looks at that act of motion and traces the step backwards and says, hey, well, there's got to be a grounding for that series, that motion. And I can get into all the technicalities, but I'm just giving a broad sketch here. Or another famous way, the contingency argument. You look at things in the universe, they could possibly exist, but they didn't have to exist. Okay, they come into being, they go out of being. And every possible being, argues Aquinas, points outside of itself to another cause, every possible being. So you kind of ask the question, well, could everything be a possible being? And as you kind of unpack that, you say, well, if everything is a possible being, you end up with this infinite series that doesn't seem to be resting on anything. Because you can look at the whole universe, which, well, actually, we can argue scientifically began to exist, but we don't even have to go that route. We just look at all the different items, how they're possible. They point outside of themselves to a cause. And so if everything is a possible being, what you end up is a universe full of things that are ultimately resting on nothing. So what Aquinas argues at that point is you must have at least one necessary being. I'm going into a lot of detail here, but the basic thrust is that God is the metaphysically necessary and ultimate foundation of all reality. And I want to affirm, actually, Gary, from what you said, most theist apologists would agree with me on this point. People aren't typically going to dispute that. So if you want next, I can go into where some of the disputed points are, but that's the rough outline, which most people would agree with. That's the traditional Western conception of God, and that's what we mean by classical theism.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think in the popular imagination, we don't really conceive of God as being this ultimate foundation of everything. We kind of picture him as a being in the sky, you know, transcendent, you know, with a long beard. And so we think that in order to prove his existence, we kind of have to scale up a ladder, you know, to get to the highest, most complex thing. But actually, it's the exact opposite, because if that is God, then that isn't God, because it you know, what's holding this being up in the sky in existence, right?
That's a great point.
That's something more fundamental.
People are talking about the moon landing was in the news recently is the thing, but there's like a famous thing where a Russian cosmonaut went up into space and was like, I'm up here and I don't see God anywhere. You know, where is he? There's no God up
here. That's right.
And that's presupposing this conception of God that, you know, as Catholics, as classical theists, we never held. He's not just like some being flying around up there in the sky. No, his reality is fundamentally deeper than that. And what's cool, and what you'll read when you look at books like Five Proofs of the Existence of God with Edward Fraser, God doesn't need to be proved or demonstrated from things that are weird or kooky phenomena. Yeah. Okay, you don't necessarily have to go and find, I don't know, like a grilled cheese sandwich that had like Jesus on it when it came out of the oven and point to that as evidence for God. No. Right. The classical theists aren't looking for weird, kooky phenomena. We say, just look at the common things. Look at any act of motion. Look at any contingent thing that exists. And even those mundane things of our reality end up pointing to the existence of God. Those are our starting point, not weird or kooky phenomena. But if you want, I think what we should do next is distinguish, okay, this is kind of a broad outline that a lot of people believe in, even if people have that, you know, misconception of God flying around. Once you explain this, most theists agree on this, but I think I should go to some of the disagreements next.
Yeah, where are the disagreements?
Okay, so, and I go, this is point number two on my free PDF. Again, all of you should get this. I'll give the link at the end, but most people would not only recognize God as metaphysically necessary, but they would say he's all powerful, he's all knowing, and he's perfectly good. People are generally in agreement on that. You could talk about the definitions and so forth. But as classical theists, we also hold that God is simple, the doctrine of divine simplicity, that he's immutable, and that he is eternal, that he stands outside all moments of time. So although most theists subscribe to what are called like the omni attributes of, you know, omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence. Oh, it's hard to say. Yeah. Perfect goodness.
Right.
Classical theists, we go further. Okay. We accept the whole batch of attributes that are commonly held by patristic and medieval writers, and those famously include divine simplicity, immutability, and eternity. And what we find in modern theists and so forth, and evangelicals and some other people, they're a little more hesitant to accept some of those attributes, and they're more willing to just kind of cast them to the side or say, you know what, there's some problems here. We don't need to hold these. Whereas as Catholics, and I'll get to this later with the reasons, no, these attributes are actually enshrined in authoritative councils, like the Fourth Lateran Council and the First Vatican Council actually endorsed these attributes and classical theism in general. So it's really not an option for us to throw them off to the side. But if you want, I can go into briefly what they mean, or perhaps some of the problems people have with them, and show how, you know, just a little way to think about it. And then we can go to more of that next. But what do you think about that, Gary?
I'd like that. Why don't we talk about what exactly do you mean when you say God is simple? You know, God is eternal. Maybe we should define terms there, because one thing I love, by the way, with classicaltheist.com is that the interviews you have, they're really geared for amateurs, for beginners, to kind of get your feet wet with this stuff. So, yeah, why don't we do that?
Yeah, so, and I kind of model it off of Fazer's book, where he says each chapter starts in the shallow end of the pool, and then you walk in deeper and deeper. So I bring on some guests who get into some technical stuff, but they're always going to be bringing it back to basics that we can all understand. All right, three attributes. Divine simplicity. It's actually mostly a negative claim about God. What we mean is that God is not composed of any parts, whether physical parts or metaphysical parts. He's an undivided, undifferentiated, absolutely simple reality. Okay, and this could be a little tricky, because it ends up entailing that, like, you know, when we think of God's goodness, God's power, and God's wisdom, in our minds, those are different things. You know, they entail different distinct aspects. But in God, in the one reality that is God, those are all unified. And a lot of that comes from, or this reasoning comes from the Platonic or Neoplatonic principle that everything that's composed, that's held together in some way, is going to, again, point outside of itself or need an explanation for why it's composed. So if God ends up being composed of different parts, well, then he cries out for an explanation that's more fundamental. But if, as we've already argued, that God is the most fundamental, he's the ultimate ground of reality, well, then he can't point outside of himself to another explanation. So that rock bottom reality, whatever it is, must be absolutely simple. That's the first thing.
Very good. Yeah, so that's kind of like the third rail. If you ever come up with a conception of God that involves something more fundamental, then that's not God.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then so now from that, you know, well, actually, there's two other attributes that are associated. They're pretty close by. But divine immutability, that refers to that God, in his divine nature, he doesn't change in any way. And what I found is that actually this is a tough one. So I have an illustration to help people out with this. That means God doesn't improve. He doesn't get worse. He just possesses the plenitude of perfection all at once. Okay. Now, you know, you might be thinking about Jesus again. If you're thinking about Jesus, yes, Jesus can change. He has a human nature. But how can we maintain divine immutability? You know, doesn't God create the world? Isn't he acting? Isn't he like doing stuff? How can we say he doesn't change in his own divine nature? Don't you think that's a question that most people are going to ask? When I'm telling you, even Catholics, when I propose this, that's a question they ask. So we'll have to answer that on the other side of the break.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a great cliffhanger, John. Yeah, we're talking with John DeRosa, classical theist, about classical theism. Stay tuned, folks. More on the other side of the break.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Master Apologist John DeRosa of ClassicalTheism.com fame, and about classical theism and how it differs from another version of theism known as theistic personalism. And before the break, John, you talked about the contested areas of simplicity of God, and now you're talking about immutability of God. And I like the way you define that as like God can't lack something, so it isn't like there's anything for him to change to. You know, there's no potential there for him to be actualized. But you left with a great cliffhanger, so I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. And actually, let me just say quickly to the idea that there's classical theism and then the other brand, which thinks about God on more of the model of the human person. I don't know about that term, theistic personalism. That was a term coined by Father Brian Davis when he was writing about this. But I just be careful. I'm not sure if you're talking to other people who hold different conceptions of God. I don't know if it's a pejorative term or not, or if they may not like it. So just ask them, you know, how do you think about God? What term do you use? And what do you think is wrong with classical theism? But let's go back to divine immutability. You gave a reason for why. I actually didn't mention that, but I'm glad you brought it up. Why would we hold God as divinely immutable? What Gary Machuda is just pointing to is the idea that in Aquinas' first way, we get down to pure actuality or an unactualized actualizer. If you listen to the episode with Dr. Fazer that Gary had on, he talks about that. And then if he has no potentials in himself, well, then he can't become something else. He doesn't have the potential to change. But there's a huge concern, as I left you with the cliffhanger. Christians worry, well, if he can't change, how can he create the world? How can he act? I'm worried God can't do anything. He just sounds like a frozen, inert rock. Like, that's awful. I'm not believing that about God. I mean, okay, maybe these councils are going to force me, but this is awful. This sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. Let me give you one illustration that I think will help you understand this. And I got this from Father Brian Davis, but Edward Fazer also mentions it in Five Proofs. And he says, you look to the example of teaching. So look at the example, and then we'll apply it back to immutability. Okay. Teaching and learning, I should say. When you have a teacher, and when you have a student, the question you have to ask is, all right, when does the student learn something? And what causes the student to learn something? And then the all-important question, where does the learning take place? So, okay, when does the student learn something? Perhaps he's in a lecture hall. You're up there. You're writing stuff on the board. Maybe you're doing some readings. Maybe there's a class discussion. That's when it occurs at some time and place.
Okay.
How does the student learn something? Okay, well, yes, the teacher is impacting, influencing. Maybe someone else says something. Maybe it's something he wrote down on the board. But then the key question, where does the learning take place? The learning doesn't take place in the teacher who's up there talking, writing, doing stuff. The learning takes place in the student. And what we can glean from this illustration actually refers back to your finding the fallacy for today, the fallacy of accident. It's true that in the material world, when we cause other things to happen, okay, when I throw something out the window, when I'm, you know, whatever, pushing some books on my desk, I'm changing as I'm doing it. But the fundamental essence, this is where Father Brian Davis is so clear, the essence of what it means to cause things to happen, to cause an effect, that takes place in the thing that is affected. The learning takes place on the side of the student. So bring this back to God. What we end up saying is, yes, it's true. In his own divine nature, God is absolutely immutable. But that doesn't mean he can't cause anything or that he can't cause change in the world. It's just that when he does cause changes in the world, it takes place on the side of the effect, only in the world. Picture it almost like the learning, which is in the student's mind. And God, you know, in his own ways, which we can't grasp entirely, you know, he's radically different from us as his own divine nature, right, has the ability to do that. He can bring about effects without changing in himself. So you don't need to worry that because he's divinely immutable, you don't have to worry that he can't do anything. In fact, he can do more and way cooler stuff than we can ever imagine.
That's right. Yeah, I love that. That's a great illustration. It's so tempting for us to kind of try to conceive God or imagine God as like how we would be, you know?
Right.
But we're really talking about two radically different realities, I guess you could say.
And I'll give you one more quickly. With divine eternity, you know, this refers to the fact that God exists independently of the created timeline. Some people say outside space and time. You know, he's not infinitely old, but he's like the creator of all time itself. So he's not in that. He's present to it, and he sees it, and he understands it as its creator. But to God, you know, what we call past, present, and future is known in a single eternal moment. And that's, again, we can't really wrap our heads around what's that like, because we're not God. But people might also be worried about this, like, well, God, that's kind of sounds boring. He just has one moment. You know, isn't it exciting? We get to like look forward to things that are coming up, or, you know, look back on our past accomplishments. But God, again, he's just like frozen, stuck there in one moment. Kind of sounds kind of boring. And I got this, I'll just give a quick explanation from Dr. Eleanor Stump. I thought this was good. What she described is, she says, well, let's think about what you got for a second. What do you really have? In when it comes to time, what do you really have? Take like a ton of time, take like 100 years. Okay. Well, you can't experience 100 years all at once. Maybe you're experiencing something in that first year. Okay. Just look at 1 year. Well, you can't experience that 1 year, you know, all at once. Maybe you're just experiencing the first month of that year. And you kind of see where this is going. Well, you can't experience the month all at once. Maybe let's look to that first day of that month, or the first hour of that day, or the first minute of that hour. And what you do, and St. Augustine does something similar in his confessions when he's talking about time, is you get down to like this razor's edge, this now moment, this, you know, infinitesimally tiny duration, and that's all you've got. That's all we've got at any one particular moment in time. That's our quote-unquote now, so to speak. But think of God, okay? When you think of, you know, if you've had a child, the birth of that child, their baby, when they're a baby, when they're growing up, all the beautiful things that are happening, you know, when they get older, that's lost to us. We can no longer experience. But to God, his now, quote unquote, is present to everything, past and future. It's metaphysically bigger than ours. Our childhood selves and our future selves, they're not lost to God. Okay. He understands them and sees them as its creator. And so it's actually pretty marvelous to think about a little bit. Again, we can't grasp it. People want to step inside to the divinity. They want to say, oh, I get it. You know, if I were God, it would be like this. I'm sorry. We're completely different realities. We can't step inside the divinity in the sense of possessing fully the divine nature. But that's the beautiful thing of Catholicism. Although we can never become the creator, by his grace, we can become partakers in the divine nature, and we can get a small participation of it. We're never going to understand, like, our consciousness is never going to be divine consciousness. It just doesn't work like that.
Right.
But he's taken us up into his beauty. That's what we understand as salvation. But so I would say divine simplicity, divine immutability, divine eternity, those are all eminently reasonable. They could be deduced from the proofs of God, and we should hold them as Catholics because they're enshrined in our authoritative councils.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, if you can comprehend the incomprehensible God, that's the third rail again. That's not God.
Exactly.
Yeah, beautiful job. And you're right. Not only do we have the declarations of the Church to help us, but it's really embedded in those very basic proofs of God. It's implied. You know, it's just
right. And that's the second part.
Teasing it out.
Exactly. That's the second part of my PDF, which you can get at classicaltheism.com/talking points. But the first part is, what is classical theism? We go through some of the attributes, the definition, compare it to other things. As you've said, what you're calling the third rail, he's radically different than us. If you're thinking about him as a creature, you're not thinking about God. But then the part two is, why should we hold to it? And I give four reasons there that I can just mention quickly. But
yeah, please do. We got 3 minutes, so.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Yeah, so like, why be a classical theist when you could be anything else? And you might come face to face to this if you're arguing for God's existence, or you discover other people who have different conceptions of God. You might be tempted. You know, there's a lot of challenges to this. Why would we bother to go through holding this view if it has challenges? I think it's definitely worth it. So the first reason is that it's the conclusion that can be teased out of the philosophical demonstrations for God's existence. We didn't go through all of that today, but I mentioned a little bit in the beginning. You look at the argument from motion, the argument from contingency. You can actually deduce that God has to be purely actual, metaphysically necessary, and possess the divine attributes. Okay, you've done show with Edward Fazer. I've done some shows on my podcast. It comes out of the proofs themselves. That's the first reason. It has a philosophical basis. The second reason, like I've said, it's enshrined in multiple authoritative councils of the Catholic Church. So if we believe in Jesus and that he founded a church and we trust that church, well, then we should trust the church when it teaches us about this conception of God, which is classical theism. That's the second reason I give. I think those two are the most forceful, but I'll give two more subsidiary reasons. The next one is that I think it's the best explanation of all the biblical data. Okay. And that's harder to argue, because when you get into different biblical texts, there's going to be a myriad of interpretations. Like Gary Machuda's done, you might have to learn some stuff about the original languages, which I am not competent in at all. But I can say that when you look at the scriptures, when you look at Moses in the burning bush, when God says, I am who I am, in Isaiah, when he says, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, when St. Paul asks rhetorically, how inscrutable are God's ways? These are all ways of pointing at the radical otherness, the radical difference in nature of the divine. And then when you couple it, because there's also a lot of passages that speak of God anthropomorphically, they might talk about the arm of the Lord, or, you know, God doing this, his powerful right hand, and so forth. What you end up with is a lot of different pictures of God. And when you put them together, they wouldn't really all make sense if you physically tried to draw out a picture from all the descriptions that you get. They wouldn't make sense. So I couple that idea that the pictures don't all fit together. The Bible also speaks of God's radical otherness. Therefore, I say the best explanation of all that data is he is radically other, and he's condescended to us so we can understand him in various ways with those pictures.
Very good. Well, hey, we're chatting with classical theist John DeRosa about classical theism. More on the other side of the break, folks. You listen to Hands On Apologetics. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics, and we are chatting with Master Apologist John DeRosa about classical theism. And before the break, John was just saying, you know, why he believes this is the best approach is the classical approach, because at first it's consistent with the classic proofs of God. Also that the church affirms these attributes that you get through classical theism. And so in a cool way, John, it actually Catholic apologetics actually steps down and confirms, you know, a deeper theistic apologetics. And then you were just talking about how you said some other minor things, like it squares best with the biblical data. And I thought you said you had a fourth point.
Yes, I do. So I list four in the part two in the PDF. And I will say those last two, like the biblical data one and the one I'm about to give, those are they're not necessarily going to be as strong, because it's going to require really getting into the scriptural interpretation. But again, that's why I love it as Catholics. You know, we have the church that we can trust, who has already set out these parameters for us and said, you know, this is the God of classical theism. This is the God we've always worshiped, and he has these attributes. So we don't have to wonder if we get to a tough scripture passage we don't know how to interpret, or if we get to a philosophical problem we're like, we don't really know the answer to, what do I do? Should I, you know, think this? You know, that's the great part about being Catholic is, you know, the church, we have the church to fall back on with those tough decisions. But as a third point, and I got to give a shout out to a professor who actually helped me compile this PDF. So Dr. Robert A. Delfino, actually idea, you should get him on your show if you haven't yet, Gary, but he co-authored a book with Matt Frad on the Thomas's Five Ways. It's a great book. It's a dialogue book between a theist and an atheist. Really readable, and you could digest a lot of classical theism just in a few days reading that dialogue. But Dr. Robert A. Delfino, I contacted him. I'm like, hey, can you look at this PDF and give me some pointers? Help me fix it. As I said, we're studious amateurs over here getting into this stuff. I want like a professional philosopher. This guy, Delfino, he teaches medieval philosophy, Thomistic philosophy at St. John's University. And he's been doing that for years. He knows his stuff. So he was able to give me some pointers with this document. And it led me to think of what I call a fourth reason. And I'll give you another point Delfino said I had to add to it. But I just said, well, classical theism, it's held. Here's another reason. It's kind of an argument from authority, but I think it's a good one. It's held by many prominent ancient, medieval, and contemporary philosophers and theologians. Just to name drop for a moment, we're talking about Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Maimonides, Avicenna, Averroes. These guys, they all defended aspects of classical theism. In our time, we got Father Brian Davis, Father Herbert McCabe, who passed away in 2001, Father Thomas Joseph White. We've got Dr. Edward Fazer. I mentioned Dr. Robert Delfino. These people all defend a classical theist approach. So, and all non-Catholic Christians too. The late Norm Geisler just passed away recently. He was a notable evangelical apologist, and he was a classical theist. Norman Geisler, he wrote some great books that influenced some great apologists, some who've come to the Catholic side. And then even among Reformed Christianity, typically we're talking about Calvinism there. When we say Reformed Christians, there's Dr. Paul Helm I believe he's in England, and then Dr. James Dolezal, who teaches in the United States. These are two PhD guys, and they reside in the camp of classical theism. So this reason just notes the fact that you're in good theological and intellectual company. So if you want to go out there and read some of the works of these philosophers and theologians, ponder their arguments, you might even find more reasons than I've thought of to be a classical theist.
Yeah, very good, very good. Yeah, that's would you say it's a consensus, a historical consensus around it, or I don't know. What would you think?
Yeah, that's a good thought. I would say there's definitely historical consensus around a lot of aspects of it. And whenever you give such a diverse list of thinkers, you know, some of them might differ on certain aspects here and there. Like all those guys I just listed, I'm sure they don't all agree on every single, you know, little detail about classical theism. But I think for the broad outlines, you could certainly say it's the historical consensus. If you go into the ancient church, the patristics, the medievals, as you get into modern times, it's harder to say. You know, there's a wide variety of views. But as a Catholic, I invite you to investigate it. I think you'll find it's a really powerful conception of God. It answers a lot of questions. And, you know, at the very least, you don't necessarily need to go into this in every conversation. We can go to our common ground with, you know, any brothers and sisters in Christ who are willing to affirm, you know, God's the ultimate reality. You know, I believe he's good, he's powerful. I'm just not sure about those other things. And then you can have a conversation with them and kind of talk about why.
Yeah, very good. And for those who are listening and thought, you know, this is a really interesting broadcast, I wish I was taking notes. This is one of the beautiful things John does on classicaltheism.com is he takes the time to break these down into talking points and, you know, just lots of great helps for the listeners. And John, where could people get a hold of the breakdown for what we just talked about?
Sure. And then if I could just add one more point about the PDF, but it's at classicaltheism.com. I'll say classicaltheism.com/talking points. And you can download the newest one is What is Classical Theism and Why We Should Hold to It, or Why Should We Hold to It? So I break it down there. And the other thing I just wanted to mention, special thanks again to Dr. Delfino, is he told me something that was missing from this. Yeah. And that is another thing that classical theists will talk about as you get into more of this stuff is, well, hey, wait a minute. When we say, you know, God is good or God is powerful, do we mean that in the same way as we say humans are good and humans are powerful? And so what he pointed out, what was missing was the doctrine of analogy.
Yeah.
So I added a few points on that, and I'm actually going to have an episode on my podcast where he's going to come on to explain all of that to us. But what we end up saying is that when we predicate truths of God, well, I'll just quote Aquinas here because I got it right in front of me. We hold a doctrine of analogy, he says. These names signify the divine substance, and they are predicated substantially of God, although they fall short of a full representation of him. And that's in the Summa Theologiae, Part 1, Prima Pars, Question 13, Article 2. But the idea is that we can say true things about God, and they do refer to God and refer to an aspect of his divine nature, but not in the same way as creatures. So yes, God is good, he's powerful, he's wise, but not just in the same way that, you know, someone you know is good, someone you know is right, powerful, someone you know is wise. But you can just, because people all worry, they're like, oh, are you saying we can't say anything about God? We don't know anything about him? And that's where Delfino pointed out this doctrine of analogy is really useful as well. So classicaltheism.com/talking points. You can get the PDF on the doctrine of analogy. And then I'm not done with it yet, but I got Answering Atheist Slogans. I tried to finish it, but it's just not done. I'm sure you know, Gary, when you go back and read your old writing,
yeah,
I'm like, right, there's so much I got to change. So like, as soon as I think I'm done with the chapter, I'm like, no, I got to go back and fix this. But it's going to be 17 slogans when it's done, and that'll be a free book that people can access.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. Wow. How exciting.
Have you mentioned, we've teamed up recently. I don't know. Have you talked about this?
Yeah, actually, I was just going to bring that up. For those who have listened to, you know, Hands on Apologetics, you know, I've been teasing this live YouTube event, and it's going to have John DeRosa and also Pat Flynn, who was our guest on Monday's program. So, John, why don't you tell us a little bit about us and tell us a little bit about the freebies, too?
Absolutely. Yeah. So and honestly, with this apologetic stuff, there's so much out there. We're all about freebies, kind of synthesizing, breaking down the material just so you can get your hands on it and at least get started with this stuff. So thanks to Gary Machuda, to Pat Flynn for teaming up with me. We're going to be doing a live YouTube event together discussing how to do apologetics in the 21st century. That's like kind of the broad thing. We're going to be talking about our own stories. I know I'm already taking some notes, like, I've made a lot of mistakes in my conversations in the past. How has apologetics changed over the years? I know Gary Machuda, he's been involved in this for decades. Pat Flynn, he's got a unique story. He's a relatively recent convert. What convinced him? What does he think are, you know, some really important things to focus on going forward? So we're going to bring our own perspectives on Catholic apologetics in the 21st century, talk about how to do it well. If you want to attend it, the link is ready for the YouTube event. It's classicaltheism.com/August. Okay, just like the month, AUGUST, classicaltheism.com/August. And if you go there and enter your email, what you'll do is you're going to automatically get a quick 2-page tactical cheat sheet. We talk it, how to talk about religion without looking silly. That's kind of the fun title we came up with. You know, what is the basics, the questions I can ask, the things I need to know? You're going to get that 2-page cheat sheet just to get started right away for signing up. And then you'll get an automatic notification or a reminder for the live YouTube event, which is going to be on Wednesday, August 21st. And it's going to be 7 p.m. Eastern time, but obviously there's different time zones, so all that will be there. And if you show up, what Gary, Pat, and I are doing in the background, and I don't know, Gary, if you've been working on yours, but I'm taking some notes. I'm trying to figure out my talks. We're putting together what we call a 60-minute defense of the Catholic Christian worldview. So as a bonus, if you show up to this YouTube event, you're also going to get this bonus audio podcast where Pat Flynn is going to defend God's existence. Gary Machuda is going to talk about Jesus, and I'm going to talk about why should we be Catholic, why trust the Catholic Church as opposed to just Christian. So a lot of fun stuff we got going on, Gary Machuda. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, man, and it was nice to finally meet Pat on Monday. And boy, is he's very well read. I mean, he knows his stuff. Although he's also very humble, and I think if you said that, he would say, no, you know, I just know some things. But, yeah, well, I can't wait
for
this.
I was like, you just got such a large brain, because he dives into all this stuff, because he's also like a fitness expert.
Yeah.
So he knows like all the literature behind like, you know, exercise and fitness stuff. And then he also just like, you know, he's like read all this stuff on classical theism, on Christianity, and he's got some great talks on his show as well. So I should mention the freebie cheat sheet thing. We provide some links to your show, Gary, to my show, and to Pat's show, where we've had shows on defending the three pillars of the Catholic Christian worldview, that God exists, that Jesus is Lord, and that he founded the Catholic Church. And Pat came up with a great title for this. We call it the minimum effective apologetic. If you can defend those three things, that God exists, you have some good reasons for that, that Jesus is our Lord and Messiah, you have some good reasons for that, and that he founded the Catholic Church. You can do a little history, like Gary Machuda teaches us with early church father and stuff like that. You can go out there and make a case for the Catholic.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Gary. Always great to be here.
All right. That's John DeRosa of classicaltheism.com/August and sign up for this live event. Very cool stuff coming up. And talk about cool stuff coming up. We have the Terry and Jesse Show, High Impact Catholic Talk coming at you. Man, this is the fastest hour in Catholic Talk Radio, I swear. Time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here and turn over control to our world headquarters. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope everybody has a great and blessed day. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.